So, before I introduce myself, I just want to say real quick that I believe in the tent cards of Al-Anon. I'm also a member of Al-Anon, and you know the part where it says we leave outside affiliations out, other 12-step programs. I've done that for 23 years, but tonight, my name's Don, and I'm an alcoholic. Psst, Bryson, I'm an alcoholic.
He knew.
One of the funniest things I've ever heard in an Al-Anon meeting was when Bryson had like a year, he got up to the mic, he said, I know I look like an alcoholic. So I hope you got good advice about having us come. I thought, at first I'm like, they must have the wrong Don and Lisa. And I was like, what are the chances of there being two Don and Lisas where the husband's an AA and the wife is an Al-Anon? No way, it must be us. But I feel so relieved to be able to say I'm an alcoholic in an Al-Anon meeting. And I really did mean that about the tent cards. And I feel the reason we read them in Al-Anon is because it makes it safe here. And that safety changed my life. I want to thank the convention committee for everything. You guys are awesome. I had the privilege, 30 years ago in Georgia to be on the convention committee. And it's pretty much like, oh, there goes that year of my life. So I know it worked. And I'm telling you that the basket, whoever did the basket and the card, oh my God, that was so nice. That card, I got all welled up. Like, she had everybody sign it on the convention committee. It was just so sweet. And thank you so much. It really, and I'm sorry I made you guys, I flew in today. I'm sorry I made you guys nervous. But I had faith in our airlines. My sobriety date is, I brought cards. Hopefully I won't look at them the whole time, but I just didn't want to forget anything. My sobriety date is April 5th, 1982. And it's not really 4582. It's because my last time I got high, my last drunk, is so funny. I'll tell you this real quick. I got sober in Rock Island, Illinois, which is a very industrial blue-collar town. Somebody from there? Oh, okay. And I was 16, right? And it was so, I'd go to meetings and it'd be all these factory workers and me. And they used to, it could be in a room this size, and they would, how they did it there, they would count off. Like, so you would go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, all the ones over here, all the twos over there. So it always ended up like 8 people at a table. So you always had to share. And so one night they had, the topic was your last drunk. And these guys had some last drunks. And it got to me, and it was like, why huff shoe polish and treatment? And so but when I did that, huff that, it was actually shoe cleaner. I had no intention in staying sober, so I didn't make note of the date. So once I established I wanted to stay sober, I thought back, and I was like, it must have been in March, so I'll just do April 5th. Just pick a date, be safe. I'll just tell you a little bit what it was like for me. I grew up in an alcoholic home. Big shock there, I know. My dad was, first of all, my parents were divorced when I was 5. And my mom moved to Arkansas, and my dad lived in Illinois. And so I was always going back and forth. And as I got older, I would play that, right? I'd get in trouble here. I would, I need to go there, And so I'll tell you a little bit what that was like. My dad, we talk about how alcoholics cross the line into alcoholism. When I was young, he hadn't crossed the line yet. So he probably crossed the line when I was like 8. And so it wasn't always insane. He married his second wife, my stepmom, who I loved and loved me. She had a mental illness. She had probably schizophrenia. I don't know. They didn't really talk to us about it, but she's in and out of hospitals my whole childhood. Lots of suicide attempts. My brother, older brother's an addict, in and out of jails. We were that house on the block, you know, always ambulances and cops. We were that house. And I actually, recently, there's a friend of mine that lived down the street. I mean, we weren't really friends. He was like, took shop and stuff, and I was, you know, got high in the parking lot. But I wrote to him on Facebook, and I'm like, dude, could you hear my dad screaming? And he said no. So I just always assumed everybody in the neighborhood knew. My dad was very violent, alcoholic. When he drank whiskey especially, we could tell by the way he drove down the driveway if we needed to hide. And, you know, it's growing up in alcoholism, it's just like you get that sixth sense. Like you can read a room, you can read a person. I could just tell by, he didn't have to say anything. I just knew. But, you know, here's the thing about my dad. You catch him when he had two beers in him, you could get anything you want. Like we used to plan our Friday nights. We'd go to the bar and we'd like get there about 2 hours after he got there, and we'd go in and ask for money or something, and it was just in a good mood. These are my boys, you know, like, you know. But man, if you messed up, if your timing was off, there was hell to pay. And then down at Arkansas, my mom's, which when I was real young, I spent most of the time there, and I spent the summers with my dad. My mom married this guy who shouldn't have allowed to be around children, if you know what I mean. And my sister got the worst of that, but I got some of it. And, you know, and he was just a stupid redneck on top of it all. And it was just, I don't know. I'll tell you, this is explain who he was. I must have been like 7 or 8. And my mom, we were poor at my mom's. And so, you know, trailer courts and, you know, projects, like that's where we lived. And we didn't have any money for supper. And so he says, come with me. I think it's because, you know, if you have a kid with you, they're not going to think you're shoplifting. He goes into the grocery store. And we go down the bean aisle. Like, this guy's such a redneck. He's going to steal a bag of beans. Like, if you're going to take the chance, get a steak, right? Like, So he, like, and I'll never forget, he was putting the bag of beans down his boot. And this mom and a girl my age came around the corner. And the look on that mom's face when she grabbed her daughter and, you know, dragged her away from us. And I was so ashamed. And, you know, it's never left me. That memory will always be there. So, you know, and the other thing about growing up in my family is I always used to think, like, somebody's made a big mistake here. I clearly do not belong with these people, yeah. Right? And I just always just wanted to get away. And I just didn't have a lot in common with them. So, I'll talk a little bit about my using. I got sober at 16. So if you can imagine, it must have been hell, you know, those years before that. And it was. I mean, it was, you know, there was some fun. But I started smoking. The first time I smoked pot, I swear to God, I was 9 years old. And I always have, like, my brother was 4 years older than me. My best friend in Arkansas was 2 years. So I was always, and I looked older. I was just always with older people. And, you know, and by the time I was 12, I had done acid by the time I was 12, you know, smoked pot, drank. I got arrested for my first burglary when I was 12. Like, I was on my way to prison. Like, it was very clear to everyone involved. Wow, only, that was a quick 40 minutes. but I'll tell you about one night. So I was a freshman in high school, and it was Memorial Day, so I must have been 14. 14? Yeah. It might have been 15. No, 14. Anyway, I got out of school early because I got a note from my dad. We were going to go camping, and I didn't want to go camping, but I wanted that house to myself. So my plan was, got out of school early so I didn't have to go to afternoon classes. I was going to just hide in the neighborhood until he left, and then I was going to go home and have a party all weekend. But my friend Spook, His name was Larry Casper, you know, Casper the Ghost, and it ended up being spooked. But we were getting high at the church, which is what we did in our neighborhood. It was in the parking lot. And my dad came by, and I'm like, oh, man, you got to get out of here. And so he took off. And then he went down this, what we called the middle road, where my grandparents lived. But we lived on the far road, which we thought my dad was going to go. My dad came, he had gone and bought a bunch of beer, and he was bringing some to my alcoholic grandparents, you know, because he was a nice guy. Old Milwaukee was on sale. And so I ducked down. It told Spook, I just go. And my dad waved him down, and Spook let me down and stopped. And so my dad was like, get in the truck. And I was like, you know, so I was busted. And he was pissed. But he wasn't drinking, so I wasn't going to, you know, I wasn't going to hear about it until he was drunk. But so we ended up going to this place in the middle of Iowa on the Skunk River. And it was just this little camp with two of his alcoholic buddies. And one of them had a kid that was like 2 years younger than me. And he was always like, you know, every time we would hang out, he was like, can Donnie spend the night? They used to call me Donnie. But I was like his hero, you know what I mean, because he was a little bit older. But anyway, so I forgot this. On the way there, my dad and his buddy were in the front. I was in the back of the camper. My dad stopped, came back, opened the door, and said, what kind of beer do you like? And I was like, okay, this is a trick question. But I took a chance, and I said, Budweiser. And he went into the store and came out with a case of Budweiser. And his buddy told him on the way there, Buddy Bill, that was his name, but we all called him. Alcoholic, of course, lost one arm in the factory years ago. I'd seen him drive a stick shift drunk with one arm, I'm telling you. This guy could do anything. But he told my dad, he's like, of course he doesn't want to go with you. Like, he's a teenager. He doesn't want to go spend, you know, buy him some beer. So my dad bought me some beer. So, and I started drinking that beer early in the day. We got to this campsite. It was just a couple picnic tables on the side of the road. And their plan was going to go run some trout lines and catch some catfish. But anyway, these guys came by because they'd left their keys at the picnic table. And I could tell right away they were partiers. And I said, hey, you know, just made a deal. They were going to come back and pick me up later. And so I'm standing up at the bridge, and the little kid's with me, and they come by and pick me up. Carload of just Iowa partiers. We go out smoking Iowa ditch weed, drinking, just drinking all day. And then when I came out of the blackout, I was driving the car. And I don't know if you remember, but I wasn't old enough to know how to drive yet. And it was a different car. It was a black Dodge Dart, and it was a 3-speed on the wheel. I had never driven before. I especially hadn't driven anything with a clutch. And I don't know how, and I just came out of the blackout, and I was gliding down this hill, and the guy whose car apparently it was sitting next to me, and he said, make a left at the motel. So I pulled in this motel, and he gets out and doesn't come back. We're sitting there for like a half hour, and he doesn't come back out. And I'm like, what the hell? So... And I killed the car on the way in, you know, that thing when you don't do the clutch right. And so I go inside, and there's this woman behind the, what we would now call a Karen, right, behind the counter. And she, I just realized I forgot to start my clock. I have no idea where I am. You're going to help me, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I go up to the counter, and I said, you know, I'm with this guy in this car. She's like, my son, Steve? And I said, yeah. And I'm like, do you know where he is? And she's like, no, I told him not to drink and drive. And I said, well, that's okay, because I was driving. And I swear to God, she said, well, you're more fucked up than he was. Get out of here before I call my husband. And so I left. I had no idea where we were. Like, last thing I remember, we were sitting next to a cornfield. Now we're in some town. Like, I had no idea where I was. And Terry was so, the kid was so scared. He's like, what are we going to do? And I'm like, we're going to steal that damn car. I still have the keys. So I go by and look, make sure they're still in there. And the mom saw me, came out, took the keys. And it's like, get the hell out of here. And so we just started walking. And I'm like, okay, we'll hitchhike. And he's like, hitchhike? Like, that was my major form of transportation, hitchhiking. But he had never done it. And so we started hitchhiking. And he was scared. And there was two highways, you know, an intersection coming up. And I had no idea which way to go. Even if we got a ride, I wouldn't know. I would just say, take me to the Skunk River. Hopefully it wasn't very long. But then this car pulled up, not the Dodge Dart, this other car, and it was a bunch of people in loud, blaring rock music, and I'm like, oh, this could go bad. This could go bad. And Terry's like, I don't know, man, I don't know. And I'm like, just come on. And they opened the door, and it was the people that had picked me up. And the guy at the hotel was in the back seat with like four other people. They were like, get in! And I got in, and he was just like, passed me a joint and said, fucking parents, man. And so they took us back to the camp out. They weren't prepared for the three very angry alcoholic factory workers that were there, that were pissed off, that had no idea where their kids were. They literally chased them. Like, they dumped us out, and they were chasing, and just, it was scary. Somehow, I didn't get in trouble. Like, those guys became the bad guys. And so that night, I had that case of Budweiser. I started drinking again. And my dad and his friends all went to bed, and I remember, I did it. I finally outdrank my dad and his friends. And I was like, that was a good day, man. And so that was a typical time for me. That's, you know, I just drank or used. I didn't differentiate. And sorry, I'm gonna cuss once in a while here. We do that in AA, but and Betty, yeah, I'm glad you stayed up past your bad time.
I'm not gonna say one word.
So when I came into Al-Anon, I went to Church of the Chimes with Marjorie. Yes. And like, I don't know, it's like, yes. I think Betty Ann and Marjorie were like kind of like the mafia. They split up the territory. Betty Ann had the West Valley, and Marjorie had the Sherman Oaks and Encino. And so, but...
Uh-huh.
I know. So... That, you know, was when I was 14 or 15. By the time I was 16, I dropped out of school when I was 15. And by the way, I started smoking in front of my parents, both sets of parents, when I was 13. Like, it was just insanity. Like, look back at it now, just insane. But, so I got arrested for a bunch of things, two different police departments within, like, 3 days of each other. And it was bad. It was burglaries, and... I got a probation officer, and she took me out to this ranch called Arrowhead Ranch, and it was where it was like juvenile, you know, juvie. And she was like, "Okay," and you know, she had one of her people there, and so you know, he showed me around and stuff. And it's like I clearly did not want to be there. Like they got up and worked; it was locked. It was just, you know, scary people. And then she said, "Okay," when we got in the car, she said, "You can go there, or you can go to treatment." This place called Riverside Retreat. And I said, okay, I'll go to treatment. And so I went to treatment. I had no intention of staying sober. I was 16. I was very glad to go to treatment because my dad had found out, and I hadn't been at home since he, at the same time when he was drunk. There was a game we would play with my dad. Like, if he took too long to back down the driveway, we would hide. And sometimes I would pull the couch out and then sleep behind the couch and just stay like that because I was scared, right? And so, like, we had played that game. I hadn't been there when he got drunk. And so I was glad to go to treatment. So I went to rehab. It was a place called Riverside Retreat in Rock Island, Illinois. It was 12-step based. First time I worked the steps. They do it a lot different now. Back then, you didn't really write the first step. You just did the first step. You know, it was a lot different. But, you know, it was weird. I did my first fifth step with a priest, which, I, you know, wasn't Catholic. And I don't think he was ready for what I told him. And so, you know, while I was there, I got high once before I huffed the shoe polisher. But the somebody brought in some pot, and I knew I was going to get high the next day because it was a dance. And so we went to our AA meeting, and I was 29 days sober. And I'm like, I don't want to pick up a dirty chip. I'm going to take a chip tonight. And so that was my thinking. Like, picking it up early, lying to everybody was fine, but I didn't want to pick it up dirty. And so I got high, and I got busted for that. But the shoe cleaner, the night I huffed the shoe cleaner, I'll tell you what happened. You know, they talk about in AA a moment of clarity, and I mean, I'm serious. I didn't have clothes, right? Like, I was just Levi's and just, like, and they made my dad, you couldn't wear jeans there, so they made him go buy me some clothes, some corduroys, some nice, like, suede shoes, and the guy at the shoe store talked him into, my dad would buy anything, talked him into buying suede shoe cleaner. And the first time I smelled it, I'm like, I know you can huff this, man. I could tell. Like, anybody that's an alcoholic and an addict and does that huffing, you can tell when you smell something. And I knew. And so I started huffing it. And then I'm like, I'm out of here, man. I'm out of here. So I snuck down the back stairs. I went to the bar. It wasn't locked. And, you know, the push bar to get out. And I looked out in the parking lot, and I was like, okay, I could break into those cars. And then that moment of clarity happened. I'm not saying it was God, but a voice in my head said, if you leave, you're going to spend the rest of your life in prison. And it scared me. I heard it. It changed my life. I went back upstairs, got in bed, and I haven't had an honest desire to drink or use anything since then. And I wish I could say that, you know, that it was some great thing, like, oh, you'll have a great life if you get sober. But no, it was just, I did not want to go to prison. So I was introduced to AA there, and there was this guy, Barney, so I was there 9 months. And I'll say this real quick, too. I have no idea how I'm doing on time. But,
18 minutes.
How many?
18.
Okay, I'm doing great. What was I gonna say? Oh, Barney. This guy, I was there 9 months. And so the insurance stopped paying for the factory insurance after 30 days. And they just, I mean, this was 19, you know, this was a long time ago, 82. And they just wrote it off. They said, he can stay. So I stayed for 9 months. And I guarantee you I would not be sober today if I hadn't stayed there 9 months. I had a great counselor. But anyway, Barney would come. So since I was there, they would, like, have Barney come up every 4 weeks to speak, because it was adults there too, and the adults were, you know, 4 weeks and they were gone. And so this guy was just this old, obnoxious, just gravelly voice, you know, chain smoking alcoholic, and he had I could tell you his story better than he could, because I heard it every month. But he always ended his story, and he would say, you know, this is rehab. He was like, I don't care if you like AA, I don't care if you like the people in AA, if you want a chance, and he'd always say, I'm not saying you're going to have a great life, but if you want to have a chance of having a good life, get your ass into AA and stay. And I hated him, but those words have never left me. And I've repeated them so many times. And he was right. You know, he was right. Just get your ass in AA and stay. So Barney helped me. And then, you know, I got a sponsor on the outside, started working the steps with him. It was a little different. He made me start over on the steps. He's like, I don't care. Here's 12 and 12. Start over. It was decided by my probation officer and my counselor, they didn't want me to go back home because they know I'd start using again. They didn't want me back in that environment. So when I went to court for the burglaries, they made me ward of the court, which meant the state of Illinois had custody of me. And then, which was kind of cool. Like, no one had custody of me. Like, you know, I took some summer classes when I was 16 at the college, and they were like, oh yeah, your government, yeah, you got Pell Grant, no problem. But So it was decided I was going to go into a foster home. And I'll tell you how lucky a person I am. I don't know if I can say this without crying, but this woman, Barb, her mom was an alcoholic. They lived in Minnesota when she was a kid. She was in and out of foster homes because her mom was an alcoholic. Her mom was on the street. And then, when Barb was an adult, for the last year and a half of her mom's life, her mom found AA. And it changed her life. And for that year and a half, she had her mom for the first time ever. And she was so grateful to AA that she went looking for a kid that was trying to get sober that needed to go in a foster home. And you're looking at that kid. And it was, I mean, you hear about foster homes like being bad. This was out in the country. They had 5 acres. They had motorcycles. They had horses. I mean, we had to work our asses off on the 5 acres. But, and I was the only foster kid. There was 4 of their kids and me. And I'm telling you, like, they always tell this story is that I got there and the first night we had dinner. And I was like, guys, you didn't have to do all this for me. And they told me a couple years later, like, we were just looking at each other like, we do this every night. They just, you know, I'd never been a part of a family like that, really, you know? And so it really changed my life. And she would take me, you know, remember I was only 16. I still hadn't learned to drive. She, like, would take me to the next, we lived out in the country. She would take me to the next town to AA meetings and go have coffee until I came out. It just really, really, I'm so lucky. And I feel like that's happened to me over and over in my life. So I actually wrote on this card, yada, yada, yada. So I just want to talk a little bit about Al-Anon. So, okay, I mean, a lot happened, right? I got in Al-Anon when I was 19 years sober. I had gotten married, had a child, got a divorce. You know, she was, you know, recovering addict. You know, so there was a lot happened that I'm skipping over. That's the yada, yada, yada. So when I was 19 years sober, I was actually dating a woman who was in Al-Anon, and she's like, heard about my child. She's like, you probably need Al-Anon. Like, you should go. And so she told me about the Monday night Sherman Oaks meeting, and we used to be at the Jewish Center back then. And so I went the first night, and I was sitting in the back. And I don't know if this, I'm sure you've had meetings like this if you haven't been to that one in particular, where like 120 people, lots of newcomers, lots of tears from the newcomers, and just these newcomers got up there and they just started sharing these just god-awful, gut-wrenching stories about the alcoholics in their lives. And so I loved it, and I like got home and I think, you know what, I'm going to go back next week and tell them to leave those alcoholics. Like, so I went back to tell him that. And I raised my hand as a newcomer. And I went up there to the podium for 120 people and cried my eyes out. I'd been going to meetings for 19 years, had never cried once in an AA meeting. And the first Al-Anon meeting, because it's safe here, I cried my eyes out. And crying changed my life. I felt got rid of that pain that I've been carrying around from my childhood. Like, and it was so weird. It's like I got to see my disease of alcoholism, how it manifests in me is to not feel. Like everything, every bad decision I ever made was to not feel, and it was because those childhood feelings. So, you know, I'd been to therapy, I'd been to, you know, lots of different things, but Al-Anon was the only place that I felt safe enough to feel those feelings. So I really thank you from the bottom of my heart. And then, you know, I had done 4 steps, you know, by then, obviously. And the last one I'd done, my sponsor was like, you don't have any resentments? Like, what about your parents? And I was like, yeah. But you know, what I learned once I got down on my resentment was so big about my parents that it was just part of me. Like, you know, I don't know how to explain it. Like, when I got sober, I left. I left my family. I thought I'd left it all behind. You know, and I wasn't perfect in sobriety. I was like, you know, there's adult children of alcoholics. Like, most of them are really super responsible. There's like 1 out of 10 that are super irresponsible. That was me. Like, I was sober, but I was super irresponsible. And so it wasn't like I was perfect. Anyway, so I came into Al-Anon, and I was, you know, from survival to recovery. I don't know if you've read that book, but it changed my life. I would just read that book and cry. I remember once I was at CVS waiting on a prescription, and I had it with me. And so I was reading it, and I started crying. I didn't want anybody to know, so I was sitting next to the sunglass thing. So I took the sunglasses off, kept reading. The tag was hanging down. I didn't care, but that book has changed my life. And I worked the steps out there, and it talked about in the second step in that book, it talks about, you know, one definition of insanity is to keep hoping for a different past. And, like, that hit me like a baseball bat to the gut, because that's exactly what I was doing. And so I was lying in bed one night, like, probably like 6 months into Al-Anon, and I was thinking about those parents I told you about, you know, the alcoholic dad, the violent alcoholic dad, the schizophrenic stepmom, the abusive stepfather, and then my mom who buried her head in the sand. And I started thinking about them. And I realized the only one I didn't resent was my stepmom. And there was a lot of shame about that. You know, there were people in the neighborhood, like this one guy down the street, he didn't know we were there trying to buy pot or something. He didn't know that I lived in that house. And he's like, "Do you hear about the broad down the street that tried to drink bleach to kill herself?" You know what I mean? Like, I could just give her my fucking gun, is what he said. And so I had a lot of shame about it. But I didn't resent her. And so I was just like examining that. And I was just like, because she has a mental illness. And then that thought came to me again from that voice that said, so did they. And that ice ball that had been carried in my heart just melted instantly. And I forgave my parents. And had you told me, if you go into Al-Anon, you'll forgive your parents, I wouldn't have come. I would not have come. You know, so Lisa and I met at that meeting, not when we were newcomers, it was like a year later. I swear. Yeah. But our kids, they had daycare there. So both our kids were in daycare. We each had like a 5-year-old. How am I doing?
Another 7-8 minutes.
Okay. That's perfect. You're lucky if you get that in Al-Anon at all, 7 or 8 minutes. That's like a long time. My daughter, who used to be my daughter, is now my son, wanted to have a play date with her son, right? And that's how we got together, it was those two. And her sponsor was like, "Oh, play date, that's what they're calling it these days, huh?" And I'll just tell you this, and I'm gonna let Lisa tell most of the story. Those two kids brought us to our knees with their addiction and alcoholism. When that started happening, I felt like I'd never stepped foot in an Al-Anon meeting. It was just a whole new world, a whole new depth of pain, powerlessness, like I never, ever, I remember once my daughter at the time was, suicidal. Like, we would, like, couldn't, we had an open door policy. She couldn't shut her door. And then she had one night, and I went and put my hand on the doorknob the next morning to open it, and I was just like, she could be dead. And then the next thought even scared me more. It'd become some normal. That was normal at our house. And I remember talking to my sponsor. Lisa was talking to our friend Lynn about getting Drew in a place, and I just didn't want to do it. Like, I'm like, you know, I've heard of this therapy. You just, you know, attach a leash to them. And I did not want to let go. I did not want to admit that I couldn't do it. I didn't want to admit that I was a bad parent. And my sponsor was like, "Don, just let the professionals take care of it. Just trust the professionals." And I just cried in Lisa's arms and was just like, "That's my baby, that's my baby." But that was the deepest first step I've ever taken. Just complete powerlessness. Our life is unmanageable. And that story gets better. I'll let Lisa tell that. Knock on wood. They both seem to be doing good right now. Thank God. Okay. The yada, yada, yada makes it go fast. So I want to talk real quickly about something. The reason I flew in today is because I was at this other convention. And it was
That's
okay. That was Joey Boing Boing. I used to read a story to my kids. But anyway, I went to this thing. It was another convention. It was for people that, I'll tell you what happened. In 2021, September 19th, 2021, I got my results back from Ancestry, or 23andMe. And there were two half-sisters on there I never heard of. And so it turns out my dad isn't my dad. And it was another alcoholic who literally drank himself to death long before I could meet him. But he had four daughters, and they welcomed me with open arms, and I fit in with them immediately. It was like I grew up in the wrong family. And don't get me wrong, they didn't have a good childhood either. The dad was an alcoholic and, died with liver disease. But finding that out just sent me in a different direction, right? It affected my life. It affected my marriage. It's devastating news. On one hand, it was exciting, right? And I found out I wasn't Norwegian, which broke my heart because I'd been to Norway. I went to Norway and found the farm that they sold in 1850 to come to America. And then I find out I make Norwegian meatballs for Christmas dinner. I have a Norwegian flag on my wall, and I'm not Norwegian at all. So I started a podcast and have people tell their stories on it. And so this convention was for people like that. And I went there because they wanted me to be on a panel. And I just want to tell this real quick. I got a text while I was on the plane saying, Shirley just mentioned you from, she was like the main speaker, just mentioned you from, and gave you a shout out and said that she wouldn't have been here if it wasn't for you. And it's true. She was like, if I told you, she was switched at birth. It was this crazy friggin' story. Ruined everybody's lives. And it was like 20 years ago, but I like researched and found her. Like she'd been married a couple times. It wasn't the same last name. And when I called her or I texted her or on Facebook and said I wanted her to be on my podcast, she's like, you're not going to believe this, but I just finished my manuscript to my book today and submitted it to my agent. And I've never talked to the press about it, but I think that God sent me to you or you to me, and I want to be on your podcast. Anyway, now she's the main speaker, and I just did a little panel. I'm not going to, but I learned that here. Take the pain, take whatever it is, be of service, and help others. And so that's why I made all these guys nervous. But, and what are the chances of the only two things this year people want me at for a weekend are the same weekend? I guess it's one out of 52, but actually it's not that bad. But I was so sad to leave there, but I was so happy that I was coming here. Like, it wasn't a loss. So real quickly, I just want to give you an example of how AA works. It's not that different than Al-Anon, but I want to tell a couple of stories that are connected. So I had a friend named Anton. I worked for him for years, years, years. I became friends with him. He was a total alcoholic, coke addict. He'd come to work drunk. I don't know if it was the night before or if he's still drinking. Or he started drinking on the way in, but he's that alcoholic that would call you and say, drunk, I'm like, I want to get sober. I'm going to do it this time. You know, and I just kept praying for him. And I'm like, Anton, anytime you want to go to a meeting, I'd love to take you. And he finally got sober when he had, I don't know. He died with 20 years sober, but he had, I don't know, 16 years sober, he got ALS. And devastating disease, just heartbreaking. And he had like become a runner in sobriety. He ran a continent or marathons on all seven continents, and then he couldn't walk, and it was very But we started a meeting for him because he couldn't no longer go out, and then we would go to his house, and then COVID hit, so we switched it to Zoom. And then he died, and I couldn't cry. I don't know why, I just didn't cry. I mean, I think it was a slow, agonizing death, and we were really of service to him and his family. What is that? Is that it? Oh, shit. Let me just finish this story. So Anton, I couldn't cry about it. I didn't tell anybody I couldn't cry, that I was feeling like shit, that I was feeling like I wasn't human, that I wasn't really his friend. But one day I finally, in that group, that AA group, we're now on Zoom, that started his house, I admitted it and told everybody. And this guy shared and said, my wife died. And everybody knows his wife. She was a big AA person in the Valley. And he's like, I couldn't cry for 6 months. And he goes, it'll come. Just one day it came. And, but I felt the same way you did. Cut to, it still didn't make me cry. The next week, this guy Jordan led the meeting, who I knew. He was one of those guys that constant relapser, would come in, tore up from the floor up, beat up from the street up, just dirty and and just ragged, and just couldn't get it. Just kept relapsing, but now he's sober. I mean, now he's doing great. And he's in his car, pulled over on the side of the road, and he's like, and somebody said, welcome to Anton's meeting, blah blah blah, and he's like, oh my God, I didn't know this was Anton's meeting. I got invited to. And he told this story about Anton. The last time he had came in, Jordan, to get sober, he, as a newcomer, was saying, I'm going to start running again. That's what I used to do when I was sober the first time. And Anton was a runner. And he said, Anton took me, he said, hey, Jordan, let's go for coffee. And so Jordan's like, all right. And he's like, I got to stop at this shoe store real quick. Come in with me. And Anton bought him a pair of running shoes. And he's reached in the back seat and said, here they are, I still have them, I'll never forget them. And that broke me wide open. And I cried and cried and cried for my friend that I love. And that's how AA works. It's just like, it's just, I was there for Anton, Anton was there for Jordan. It just, it takes away the shame, and we don't have to drink again. I was going to end reading this something, but I don't have time, so I'm going to end it there. Thank you guys so much. Thank you guys for asking. Join my beautiful wife.
I'm going to give you your phone.